You are listening to Issues and Ideas here on 90.1 KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Randall White. The waters of the Central Coast have seen some radical changes in recent years, including much warmer than normal temperatures, massive algae blooms, a decline in eelgrass, and a mass wasting disease among sea stars, or you may know them as starfish. Scientists are working hard to get a handle on the changing environments of the world's oceans, and one woman in particular, Cal Poly's very own biologist Jennifer O'Leary, is among those leading the way. O'Leary recently received a prestigious Pew Fellowship in Marine Conservation and is freshly back here on the Central Coast from management and conservation work she's doing in East Africa and the Western Indian Ocean. She joins us in studio today to talk about the award, how she'll be using the money, and her knowledge of the issues currently facing our local waters. Welcome to Issues and Ideas.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
And it's nice to have you in studio. We were communicating when you were in Africa, and we were going to try to do it that way, but it just didn't work out. So I'm glad we can be face to face.
Thanks. I appreciate being here. Internet was tricky.
Yes, I bet. So where were you when you found out you received this Pew Award?
Well, I actually knew about it for quite some time. So I found out last September. I was in South Africa at a conference with all my colleagues from that region. So it was a good time to learn about it. But it just got publicized recently. And at that time, I was on the coast of Kenya.
Mm. And what was the feeling?
I'm really honored. I am a little overwhelmed, but really, really proud. The Pew Foundation chooses five global marine fellows every year that they think are leaders in conservation and have great ideas to move conservation forward. So it's really exciting to be one of the five.
Jennifer, explain for us, sort of in a nutshell, what it is that you're doing in Africa.
So I'm focusing on a really big problem, which is that around the world we're establishing marine protected areas that are usually contain some part of them that are fisheries closures where we don't allow fishing and other harmful extractive uses of marine systems. And as we strive to attain 30% of the world's oceans in marine protected areas, we have another challenge, which is that we're not always ensuring that they're actually giving, these areas are giving back the benefits that we expect them to in terms of the ecological system as well as the social system. And so with my Pew Award, I'm working on a program that I established in 2009 along the coast of Kenya, but that's now expanded to Tanzania and the Seychelles, to work with government agencies that manage these areas and help them use science effectively to understand the status of the marine protected areas, the benefits that are accruing ecologically and to human communities, and also some of the threats that these systems face so that they can address the threats and make sure that these systems do not ecologically collapse, which has happened in some cases.
Give us an example, Jennifer, of some of the groups you work with to establish these goals.
So I work both with government agencies, but also I work very, very closely with fishing communities. And one of the interesting things that I've learned working with fishermen both in East Africa as well as in California is that I find that it's often the fishermen themselves that are the best conservationists. These are really the people that know and understand the marine system. They're out there every day, and they're often very, very aware of changes that are occurring and certainly want to protect the ecosystem that they rely on for their livelihoods.
Is the big challenge to keep these ecosystems intact and keep the fishing industry intact at the same time?
That is the idea. And so creating small areas that are protected from human use, we're actually hoping that in the long run, those areas will benefit fishing communities. It does take a long time to accrue those benefits. And so even here in Central California, where we've established marine protected areas just recently in 2007, we now have to work with fishing communities to assess, are these doing what we thought they would? And so one of the projects I work on is actually working with nearshore groundfish fishermen here in Central California to assess fish populations inside and outside of the marine protected areas and see if they're starting to come up now, you know, 9 years later, and if we would expect fishermen to start having benefits of those areas in the near future.
Are there early results showing whether it's going one way or the other?
What we see right now is that the sizes of fishes within the marine protected areas are getting bigger, so we don't actually find that when we do this fishing inside and out, and of course it's catch and release, we don't actually find that we're catching more fish yet, but we're we're seeing that the fish are growing bigger. And so that's good news because it means that we're probably going to have more babies coming into those populations. Usually bigger fish can have more babies. And so we'd expect future population growth within the marine protected areas. And some fishers do feel like if you fish close to the edge of the marine protected areas, you get some benefits. But I think the jury's still out and it's probably going to take time to really assess what kind of benefits might come from these and how much they're helping the local fisheries.
Can you help explain the difference between the protected areas that are off the coast? What are the main groups that cover the waters?
So when I speak about a marine protected area, I'm actually talking about areas that in most cases include a fisheries closure. And so we do have several of those. So one example is up by Cambria with the White Rock or Piedras Blancas area, and another one is at Point Bouchon. There are more moving up into Big Sur. And those actually include a zone where no recreational or commercial fishing take is allowed.
And that's different than a sanctuary.
And that is different from marine sanctuary. So marine sanctuaries tend to be larger areas. They're managed under different regulations. They don't necessarily prohibit fishing, but they prohibit other ocean uses, like they're supposed to prohibit oil and gas. And there is currently some talk about whether or not we should include this area as an extended sanctuary.
That would be the proposed Shumash sanctuary that would connect Monterey with Channel Islands.
Mm-hmm. And I think there are reasons for it and reasons against it. I know the fishing community is very, very concerned about having added layers of regulation put onto a very heavily regulated industry, which is already difficult to navigate. And so I think that's a proposal that's still very much under evaluation.
So you have research that you've done right off of the Central Coast here in a couple of areas. How was my thumbnail sketch of the issues facing our local waters?
Your thumbnail sketch was quite good, and those are all things that I think people are very concerned about. I have spent a lot of time looking at eelgrass in Morro Bay because I think that is one of the key issues, that eelgrass is a critical habitat, just like kelps in a kelp forest or trees in a rainforest or corals on a coral reef. And the Morro Bay National Estuary Program has been monitoring eelgrass over the past decade plus time, I think. And what they have shown is that eelgrass has declined dramatically, about a 97% decline. So from former of over 300 acres of eelgrass in Morro Bay to currently 10 or less acres. And so we're quite concerned about what that means for the ecosystem and what are going to be the ecological and also economic consequences of that decline.
How does the eelgrass play into the ecosystem? It acts as an area where like fish can hide and helps protect the movement of soil and those sorts of things?
So eelgrass does a number of things. So that's pretty correct. So it does provide habitat for fish. That's incredibly important. It is there are a lot of fish that actually really rely on it for habitat. It provides habitat also for invertebrates, which become food source for other fish populations. It's really important to stabilize shorelines and prevent erosion. And then it also is a huge carbon sink. So it actually takes up carbon dioxide and helps to decrease the overall amount of carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere and causing global warming.
People don't realize that eelgrass is very specific to the area. The eelgrass in San Diego may be different than the eelgrass in the San Francisco Bay, and that is indeed the case here in Morro Bay. I went out with a few boats that were replanting the eelgrass like a year and a half ago or so, and it was fascinating to learn about the importance of something that never even crossed my mind.
Yeah, I think the genetic issue is definitely there, and so we do have to be really careful about bringing eelgrass in from other systems. But at the same time, I think one of our concerns that we have, and my colleague Jen Yost also at Cal Poly is working on this, is that because the population has gone so low, we may have lost a lot of genetic diversity in Morro Bay. When you lose genetic diversity, it actually makes it quite a bit harder to restore the ecosystem because if a disease comes through, the plants are now more susceptible. And so she's doing a complete genetic evaluation of how much diversity we have left in Morro Bay to decide if we actually do need to augment with eelgrass from other systems like Elkhorn Slough or south of Point Conception down in San Diego area.
I think one issue that grabs a lot of headlines and people's attention is the mass wasting disease of the starfish, just because that's one of the first things you learn as a child. it's a starfish or a sea star, I guess is what scientists call them. But What's going on there? There was a rebound. Is that still in place?
So the rebound has been really interesting. We actually started having a rebound much later than other places. So I do have monitoring sites. I have 5 sites in Montana de Oro State Park and 5 sites at the Diablo Canyon property in the Rocky Intertidal Habitats. And in those sites, while other people started recovering, we were a little bit later. But starting about 6 months ago, we did start to see a lot of juvenile Pisastro crassus, which is the ochre star, coming back. And at this point, densities are pretty high of young, small stars. And so I'm sort of monitoring those over time to see if the sea star or starfish populations are going to recover. And things are looking good at this point for a recovery of former population densities.
Do we know what's killing them? I know that the stars get these like spots on them, splotches, mm-hmm. and then they just start decaying, right?
Yeah, the wasting disease was thought to be a viral disease, and it's sort of present in sea stars at low levels, and it's not exactly clear what caused it to get at these epidemic proportions. There's a lot of hypothesis about this, and I think the answer is still not really out there. It has happened before. So we've seen these episodic wasting disease happen. There were events in the 1970s that brought populations quite low. Usually we're able to attribute it to something, like a change in temperature. And in this case, the die-off actually started before this current warm period, so it's not quite clear what triggered it. But we're in the new stars that I've been seeing coming into this area, I don't see any signs of disease. And so at this time, they're very healthy and there's a lot of them.
Some of the changes off the coast may not affect people in their personal lives, while others can really hit the pocketbook. And most recently, the Dungeness crab season and the rock crab season were halted entirely back in November, only recently starting up again off of the central coast. A lot of it has to do with this giant algae bloom and the poison, what's it called?
Domoic acid.
Domoic acid, yeah. Right. I don't know if that's in your area of research.
Yeah, so I don't actually research the domoic acid in Dungeness crabs, although my colleague at California Sea Grant, Carrie Culver, who's in Santa Barbara, does. And I work very, very closely with the fishing populations here in Morro Bay. And what I can say is that the delayed opening of that fishery had huge economic consequences for these guys. It takes a lot of money to open up for a crabbing season. It's a lot of equipment. It's a lot of expense. They have to move around the state to go to places where crabs are likely to be caught in any given year. And so it was a really big concern. And there was a really nice effort done by the fishing community to do actually a fundraiser to help the people who had poured a lot of money into this opening and then weren't able to sustain their families through this period. So I think at this time, people are really pretty much relieved that the fishery is reopening and hope that we don't see that kind of dramatic closure in the near future. It's hard to control things like domoic acid. So, the best we can do is try to just help the fishermen through this difficulty and hope for the best in the future.
So the next 3 years, will you be primarily in East Africa or will you be spending some time on the Cal Poly campus?
So I'm usually in East Africa about 2 to 3 months out of the year. So most of my time is actually here in San Luis Obispo at the Cal Poly campus.
Oh, that's great. And yeah. Then do you spend much time on the Cal Poly research pier there in Avila Beach?
I do have some research on the pier. So right now we're actually running a trap to look at recruitment of larval crabs of multiple species to get a sense of what's happening with them. And especially since we're sort of at Point Conception, which is the southernmost boundary of some of these crab species. And so we want to sort of know how many new baby crabs are coming into the population. And so we're doing that as a trial this year to see if that information might be useful to the fishing community.
When I think of the 2 university systems in California, I think of the UC system, which is a research-based structure. And then when I think of the CSU system, I think of a more learn-by-doing structure, especially Cal Poly. That's their mm-hmm. whole slogan, learn-by-doing. How does your role fit into that? When I think of what you're doing, I think of you more in the UC strain.
Well, I'm actually in a very unique position. So my employer is California Sea Grant, which is based out of Scripps in UC San Diego. But what the SEA Grant program does is it places extension scientists in different parts of the state. And so we have people up in Humboldt State. We have people in Bodega Bay at Moss Landing, here in San Luis Obispo, in UC Santa Barbara, and also UC San Diego. Nice. And so Cal Poly does support part of my salary, and I'm permanently placed at Cal Poly. And my role is really to try to find ways to engage the community in scientific research that supports conservation and management, and really serve as a liaison between community and agencies and the scientific world. And I think the learning by doing model at Cal Poly is actually a really great model for this, because I'm able to get a lot of students involved in the work that we're doing. And so right now I have 14 undergraduate and graduate students working on various projects here in the Central Coast area, and some of them actually helping with the project in East Africa.
Well, biologist Jennifer O'Leary, congratulations on the Pew Award that you received. Welcome back to the Central Coast from Africa, and we look forward to hearing in the future where your research and experience takes you.
Great.
Regarding the waters of the Central Coast and the world, for that matter.
Thanks so much.
And you are listening to Issues and Ideas here on 90.1 KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Randall White.